And it was really cool, and it's still in use today. That's as far as I know. To give you like a quick overview on it, it basically consists in a, let's say, a James Bond level vault with the iris scanners to get in, sensor in the wall in case someone is drilling or trying to get in some other ways. It's completely isolated from any radio signal. It's basically a big metal Faraday cage. And we also selected military grade hardware, which also had the requirement to not leak any data, especially on the radio frequency level. And finally, we developed our own super minimal and hardened operating system, which was based on Linux, and our wallet software.
How is crypto security really done in a Swiss bank from somebody who helped design the crypto security protocols at SIBA Bank?
Michele Federici is the founder of Sig9 Security. Previously, he helped design the security at SIBA Bank, now Amina Bank, and he also helped design the security systems at a VC firm, and now advises companies on security design. Michele also featured in a recent report by the Crypto Valley Association. So good afternoon, Michele.
Hi, Didier. Thanks for having me.
To get started, for people who don't know you, can you describe your background and what led you into designing security systems at SIBA Bank?
Yeah, sure. So my background is basically I was always a nerd guy since I was a little kid. My grandfather was also a huge nerd, so he basically introduced me to the first computers, and we started together, so playing around with computers. Then I went to the university. I started getting more on the real stuff. And I was always particularly interested in the security aspect of it. So even when I approached the real world, I started looking for projects that would put me in the position of working on safety critical software. So my first job, for example, I worked on payment gateways, traditional payment gateways. And then on my second job, when I was still in Italy, in Bologna, I started working for this biotech company that was producing this machine to test different cancer drugs before actually moving to the crypto valley and start working on blockchain projects at the time, let's say.
So in fact, how did you discover crypto?
So to be honest, I don't remember, but it was in the very, very early days of Bitcoin. I think I just found out probably like the Bitcoin forums. I started, I was really fascinated by the idea of having like a completely decentralized system, not under the control of governments and state countries. So I just started playing around with it. At the time, we were talking about, I think, 2011. It was really different from what we see today. But yeah, so I actually, an interesting story. The first Bitcoins I got, I mined them solo on my desktop computer in about a week. So I mined an entire block. So it was still possible at the time to mine 50 bits on a desktop computer. And that was really, different times, definitely.
And how many blocks do you think you mined?
No, just one, because basically it took an entire, at the time it took about a week with my desktop computer, but it was completely unusable. And, my family wasn't super rich or whatever. So, there was the only computer that we had in the family. So knocking it out for a week, yeah, they didn't really like the idea. Also, electricity and everything, they were a bit paranoid about it. And also, to be honest, it was just a joke. I didn't really feel that Bitcoin was going to become what we know today. I think it was like $2 on super, can I say, like obscure exchanges at the time. And I was also very young, so I was just playing around. And I also took a big break in the middle from playing around in that years, and then to actually start working seriously or start believing in seriously in the project.
Okay. And then you also worked, I think, at a VC firm. Was that before or after you worked at SIBA Bank?
It was after.
Yeah. And what were you doing there?
In the VC? I was their head of IT security.
So you worked at SIBA Bank for what, 2 or 3 years, I think?
3 years and 2 months, yeah.
Can you describe maybe the major security challenges for a Swiss bank relating to crypto?
Yeah, definitely. So I could maybe start by saying that managing custody is, it feels perceived today as one of the trickiest matters in crypto, right? So personally, I've always been all in self-custody, but I also accept the reality that a lot of people simply don't want to handle that on their own, or they're scared, or they feel like they are not knowledgeable enough for doing it. So in those situations, I think you can only try to find someone reputable and skilled enough to build a proper solution and manage it for you. So we saw a clear demand for that, and that's what we tried to target in Seba. We're talking about 5 years ago. So at the time, institutions were still not really involved so much in crypto or in Bitcoin at all, or very little. But everyone was starting to look in that direction, right? So yeah, designing a big custody solution has a lot of technicalities. And, you know, the idea of Seba was to be the first global regulated crypto bank. So also the regulators and FINMA in particular were quite paranoid about it, and they were monitoring us very closely. So the biggest dilemma, I would say, in crypto, but in IT and IT security in general, for me, it's always drawing the line to what's secure enough, and also trying to avoid over-engineering and overly complicated system. Because we need to always keep in mind that complexity is one of the biggest enemies of security. And even a very, very small error in crypto can always result in a catastrophe. It's actually an interesting story about it. When I was working in Seba and then developing part of our Bitcoin wallet, I found a pretty bad bug in Bitcoin Core itself, which was also like the perfect example of how a very, very small error can lead to a catastrophe, which wasn't the case, luckily, but yeah, it could have been the case. We just don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to describe what it is you found and how you corrected it? So before we get into the explanation, let me give a few definitions that might help people understand what Mikael is saying. Bitcoin Core. Bitcoin Core is the name given to the original software version released by Satoshi in January 2009. Satoshi released the white paper in October 2008, but he released the software version to implement the white paper in January 2009. And that is called Bitcoin Core. To show that he was not mining Bitcoin secretly before he released Bitcoin Core, he included in the Genesis block the famous statement saying that the Bank of England was on the brink of another bailout, with the date of the newspaper that had that headline. So that is Bitcoin Core. And for people who don't realize, Bitcoin Core is the main software version used in Bitcoin. In Lightning, there is no specific version released by the people who wrote the Lightning white paper. The Lightning white paper is a set of protocols, but there is no specific software version released by the authors of the white paper, Taj Diria and Andrew Poon, relating to Lightning. So there are several different applications of it. And all these applications don't necessarily all have the same features. Next, the multisig. Multisig, an abbreviation to stand for multiple signatures. It means to sign a Bitcoin transaction of a multisig address, one needs multiple signatures. So for example, 3 out of 5 possible signatures need to be provided for the transaction to be valid. So it means that not one person controls those Bitcoin, but a combination of people. So for example, 3 out of 5. And what is also important is that even though several people, for example, in this case, 3 out of 5 people need to sign a signature, we need the public keys of all 5 signatories. A SegWit. SegWit stands for segregated witness. So what is segregated witness? Segregated witness is a change in the architecture of transactions. It was introduced in 2017. It allows the signatures to be in a separate attached data structure and not be computed as part of the transaction hash or the transaction ID. Segregated witness, it's an opt-in choice, meaning you can decide to use segregated witness if you want, but you don't have to if you don't want to. Legacy address, a legacy meaning the address structure before SegWit was introduced. And finally, the definition of a public address and compressed or non-compressed public address. So first,
public address, it derives from a public key. So to get a public address, in fact, first you start with a private key. You take a private key, which is just a random number, and you put it through a specific equation called an elliptic curve function. And you get a public key. And then to go from a public key to a public address, you put it through two more hash functions. But to obtain a compressed public key, the second step in the procedure is slightly different. The result is the compressed public key, you're going to get a key that's only 33 bytes long, whereas an uncompressed public key, the key will be 65 bytes long. A compressed public key is used in SegWit, and an uncompressed public key is a legacy address, basically an address format that existed before SegWit was implemented.
Yeah, sure. So basically, we needed to re-implement. So Bitcoin Core is written in C++, but our tech stack in Sveva was we were using mostly Rust, like everyone is trying to do now, because you know it's memory safe, it's easier to use. There's a better ecosystem around it. So one of the challenge was, again, we're talking about 5 years ago. So many of the tools that we see today were not available at the time. There's much more stuff today. So we had to implement some stuff on our own. And while I was writing a part of the code that needed to parse some of the Bitcoin transaction, I was trying to calculate some multisig addresses, but I was getting a different multisig address than the one Bitcoin Core was giving me, with the exact same multisig parameters. So let's say that me, you, and another person is creating a multisig together. You need to have the public key of all three. And then the software is giving you another address, which is basically, let's say, to simplify, a combination of the three. But the one with the same parameters, the one I was getting from Bitcoin Core wasn't the same that I was getting in my software. Of course, I thought I was the problem. I thought my software was bugged or something. But I kept looking at the Bitcoin specification document. I kept looking at my code and I couldn't find the error. So I started getting in touch with the Core Bitcoin devs. And in the beginning, they also said, yeah, it's probably your code, whatever, right? So it went on for a month. And after a month that I was still in the same situation, said, look, guys, I tried everything, not me. And finally, we did a test together and they realized that basically it was a bug introduced after SegWit. So SegWit was introducing some changes on how the how can I say, like how the public keys are managed. So before we were using what was called like uncompressed public keys, and now we are using compressed public keys, which were introduced in SegWit to basically ILS spend less space on the blockchain itself and make the transaction cheaper on the fee side. And basically, like, if you were creating a multisig address and you wanted to have a new batch 32 address or the latest versions of the Bitcoin addresses, you had to use only compressed public keys. I basically found out that there was a bug where, in certain cases, if you were adding a mix between the compressed and uncompressed public keys, instead of falling back to the legacy address, it was just still giving you a SegWit address, which was invalid. So basically, if anyone deposited money on that address, they were lost forever. It was pretty technical. I tried to break it down, but...
No, you explained it well. I got it. I hope the listeners will get it as well. So what was the workaround for that?
So basically, that's actually like another funny thing. So there's no workaround, and the bug is kind of still there because it couldn't be fixed without an hard fork. Because that part of the code is in what is called consensus critical code, which requires an hard fork for an actual fix. So actually, I proposed a solution, but then a core dev proposed another one, which was more complete. So its solution was merged, not mine, even if they added me anyway in the credit. So basically, the solution was on the client side. So whenever you are, it's the Bitcoin wallet that is not allowing you to do that. It's not the core consensus code. So we are basically blocking it on a higher level. See what I mean?
Yeah. So if I understand, if I understood the problem correctly, in fact, the solution is that everybody who's participating in the multisig must have a SegWit compatible wallet that generates the compressed public key. Is that correct?
Or? Yeah. Or you can also use a mix of the two, but you need to be sure that the wallet is falling back to. So it's trying to generate a legacy address and not a SegWit address. So it's just, you're just telling the wallet software, if one of the public keys are not compressed, generate a legacy address. So if you are providing a mix of the two, the wallet is automatically calculating a legacy address. I mean, this is just a technicality, actually. The fact that is going to happen on a higher level and not on the consensus code. It's just, it doesn't really matter. Let's say that there is an additional check that is forcing the wallet to generate a legacy address if at least one of the key is not compressed.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So that was a sort of fun detour in your journey at SEBA. But yeah, generally speaking, maybe do you want to describe, so sort of give an overview of other challenges that you had at SEBA, and what are some of the challenges that are specific to crypto?
So I would say like challenges specific to crypto. Well, the biggest ones for sure are performing properly secure key ceremonies and handling backups and signing devices, which is, it's still kind of the first critical point in crypto, but it's still the critical point today. So I think we still, to be honest, we still didn't find the final approach or the final UX in this regard. But there are some interesting technologies today which are going to probably improve on that sense. Like, for example, multi-party computation can be used to achieve a very, very nice improvement in that sense, because they allow for flexible multi-sig setups and more security in the sense that compared to Shamir secret sharing, for example, there is no point in time where you need to recombine like all the keys together to do a signature, but you can do these intermediate signatures so this is.
Yeah, maybe let's take a step back. Do you want to maybe explain what a key ceremony is and when you use it and what it's about, why it's important, what it's used for?
Yeah, definitely. So key ceremonies are not something specific to only cryptocurrencies and crypto in general. So they are used, for example, also for how internet is run. You know, like when you have a domain name, let's say like mikene.com, the TLS certificate connected to that domain and needs to be signed by a certificate authority. And there are few people in the world that are managing these keys, and they are rotated from time to time. So there is like a big ceremony. I don't remember how often they do it, but everything is public. You can find by searching DNS root certificate ceremony. And what is a key ceremony? A key ceremony is basically a procedure that you do to generate new cryptographic keys. And especially in a situation where you don't have full trust of the people around you. Of course, if I'm generating a key for myself, I'm not using the same procedure that I used in Seba Bank, where you basically, no one could trust any other person involved. So the idea is you set up an environment like physically and also on the software level where you try to reduce as much as possible all the internal and external risks involved in a cryptographic key generation process. So for instance, in Seba, we had some strict rules about key ceremonies. So, you know, you couldn't bring in any external electronic device. Some of the most important key ceremonies were actually run in a Faraday cage, so no radio frequency signal could get in or get out from the room. We were designing the protocols and the script in a way that no one was able to reconstruct any of the secret in any point in time, either during or after the key ceremony. And that we had multiple roles. So basically, usually you have like a master of ceremony, which is reading the protocol. You have an operator, which is executing step by step. And then you have one or more witness for external auditors, which are checking that everyone is doing, you know, his own role and is not trying to cheat in any way.
Okay. And in a bank, you're going to do a tea ceremony with whom? With other exchanges? Who are the...
No. You are doing a key ceremony. I mean, there are many, many key ceremonies. It could also be, for example, a multi-sig with other entities. But the main case was actually when we were generating the keys for wallets of our client. So for instance, like the cold storage, for the cold storage, I can explain a bit how that was working. You needed to generate a set of keys. We had a segregated wallet. So basically each client had his own wallet and that was becoming basically the deposit wallet for each of the client.
Okay. But you were doing this, what, internally on an HSM or how does this work?
So it depends. So in Seba, we try to go in the direction of an hybrid and diversified approach, let's say. So on one side, we integrated some existing custody products, especially for the hot storage and some specific use case we didn't want or didn't have the capacity to build internally, also to not reinvent the wheel, you know. But at the same time, we wanted to design our and develop our most important component, which was the cold storage, which was the crypto core of the bank, let's say. And that we did completely internally. And it was really cool. And it's still in use today, as far as I know. To give you like a quick overview on it, it basically consists in a let's say, a James Bond level vault with the iris scanners to get in. Sensor in the wall in case someone is drilling or trying to get in some other ways. It's completely isolated from any radio signal. It's basically a big metal Faraday cage. And we also selected military grade hardware, which also had the requirement to not leak any data, especially on the radio frequency level. And finally, we developed our own super minimal and hardened operating system, which was based on Linux and our wallet software. So operators, to do like to sign a transaction in the cold storage, operators need to be physically there and the signatures were done offline and broadcasted to the internet later. So after being signed, so when they cannot be. So yeah, that was like a cold storage, for example, is really different because you need way more levels on the operation side because you need to be fair. You need some of the signature need to be automated, but cold storage is technically where you put most of your money and you are not accessing every day. You're accessing from time to time. You see what I mean?
Okay. So you had a hybrid solution for that, you say, with a lot of security that you just sort of evoked. And there was a key exchange. There was a key ceremony at each time you created sort of a new wallet for each customer. Is there also a key ceremony when you want to connect the wallet of the bank to exterior participants, I mean, like an exchange or something, or to another bank who you might trade with?
Well, regarding exchanges, maybe the main, let's say, ceremony, even if it's kind of a very limited one, is for API keys. So if you are integrating, for example, with an external exchange, there's a lot of power there. You basically usually need some API keys. And with those API keys, sometimes you can do basically anything. You can trade, you can sell, you can buy, you can withdraw. So there's many implications in generating the key in a safe way. Some website, usually you click like generate new key, they show once and then they don't show it anymore. Of course, we are talking about everything. We are talking about an online system now. Cold storage is a completely different concept because everything is designed to be offline. Everything that is offline is considered hot, so it's way less secure by default. But still, of course, you need to manage to handle carefully also the API keys and also like the 2FA, for example, or the credential for an exchange account. So they're also managed in a similar way with also different backups. Also, the backups, we had multiple backups in different geographical location in case, you know, like if you keep everything in a single place, it can blow up and you can lose everything. It happened, for example, I think a couple of years ago or something like that, that one of the biggest data center in Europe blew up, basically was completely on fire. And a lot of companies lost everything. And maybe they also had backups, but they were in the same data center. So yeah, the multiple geographical location is also very important topic in backups and security management.
Okay. So yeah, so just getting back with summarize, maybe the high level security challenges related to crypto is one of the key exchange, multiple backup sites and the quality of your backup site. Anything else you'd like to evoke?
Well, there's something that I'm focusing a lot lately, and I'm thinking about it. It's the the understandability of what we are signing. So especially like in blockchains like Ethereum, where you can do very complicated and combined operations by interacting with smart contracts. When these kind of blockchains were designed, nobody had the understandability, the human understandability of transaction in mind. So basically, like for example, in the Ethereum case, if you have a smart contract deployed somewhere and the developer is not publishing on their own the API, so the definition of the function and everything, there's not much you can understand of what the smart contract is actually doing. We have some nice solution that got very popular lately, which is basically transaction simulation. So there are tools like Anvil, which is a CLI tool, which allow you to fork the chain in any point in time and locally, and then execute the transaction and see the results of it, you know, locally without actually broadcasting in the network. There is like a very, very famous service, which is called Tenderly, which is also doing the same, but online they have like a website where you can simulate transaction and also see the details of them.
Okay. Any other problems that you think still need improvement?
I know that I'm saying this after talking a lot of the technical details and maybe people will not understand me, but I think this is actually one of the biggest problems still today, UX. So a lot of people, a lot of friends which are not technical, they're still not using crypto because they are scared. They know that you can, it's easy to lose, to lose everything. They know it's easy to steal. And also they don't understand what they're doing. So now that we got mainstream institutions are investing on it and everyone is talking about it, I think we should really stop a bit and focus on you know, what user wants.
Okay, so basically, do you think the ETF is therefore a good solution?
No, not necessarily. No, but I'd love to see actually, like, you know, even a self-custody solution, which is really easy and then makes you feel secure. I'm not saying that someone else needs to do it for you, you know?
And you don't think they're easy enough now? Because I think most self-custody solutions are quite easy now. Just people need maybe a bit of education. But what are you saying? That most of your friends who are in crypto still find it a bit intimidating?
I mean, not most of them. I mean, probably today, most of my friends are actually in crypto. But I have a lot of friends and, you know, family members, which, you know, they still... And I, you know, I can see that, you know, like a friend of mine, which is also in crypto since 5 years, last year lost a few K in crypto money because he made a mistake. He sent a transaction on a wrong Ethereum layer 2. By mistake. I mean, this is stuff that is still happening and it's still happening to technical people.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So the user interface probably needs to be more easy to use and probably need more software solutions integrated directly into the software to correct any errors that the user might input accidentally, I suppose. I suppose those are improvements that still need to be brought to crypto is what you're saying.
That's another thing that I think it might be a nice evolution in the future. I'm talking about this since a while now, but I still couldn't find a proper product convincing me. But I feel like it would be nice in the future to have a sort of a very, very battle tested and simple way to handle keys in a sort of social recovery system. So basically reducing the likelihood of losing access to your funds exponentially by having ways to recover your keys through the combined action of a list of trusted people around you. So kind of custody will still be, you know, self-custody managed by yourself, but you will have a second layer where your friends can still save your ass if you do some mistake. You see what I mean?
Does this necessarily mean a multi-sig, or what do you mean?
Not necessarily. I mean, I can probably see MPC being used in that context. Maybe, you know, it could be, I mean, in the Ethereum case, probably it could be managed by a smart contract where, you know, I don't know. I mean, no one found a proper solution for it, as I mentioned, but I think there must be a way where you have this smart contract wallet where you have your keys for it, but you're also adding a set of rules to move out the funds to a new wallet in case, you know, for example, you disappear or you don't do like an hard bit after X amount of time, or this stuff that we can probably script. It's just that we no one really focused on it yet.
Okay, let me ask you a question, which is goes against my philosophy, but I'll ask you anyway. Basically, I have the impression that what you just described is what banks do within an HSM. Not that I necessarily want to have people put their crypto in banks, because I think that the crypto's greatest quality is censorship resistant. And when you put your crypto back into a bank, you give up censorship resistance. You've given the censorship quality back to the bank. But I have the impression that the whole sort of protocols to protect you from a mistake is what gets programmed into an HSM in a bank. Is that correct?
No, not really, actually. So there's two ways to look at it. So one of the approach could be, as you said, basically to delegate the custody and giving away your rights, which is very, very in contrast to the ideology of crypto. And no, that's definitely not what I meant. What I mean is that with cryptography, even in a self-custody setup, so without giving away your keys or without giving it to an institution, we could create setups and write software to still make you manage your keys, but also have a way with your friend actually to recover this key. So what I meant about this kind of social recovery, it's not you and a service or an institution or a company. I was thinking more like you and your family, because this is also like one of the underrated problems that we have in crypto today. People die, and then they die with their keys sometimes, you know? And then if I die tomorrow, hopefully not, but if I die tomorrow, I would love my fiance or my family to get my crypto. And it wasn't the case. So now I kind of created a setup to solve that. But, you know, it's not the case by default. You see what I mean? Like, and HFM is kind of a buzzword. We can consider a lot of things to be HSM, like a credit card or the SIM card of the phone. So it's basically like an hardware which is designed to prevent you to extract the memory part of it. And so hardware wallets, like also the consumer ones, HSMs. So that's something that you can use also on your own. And I'm talking about more on the software on a little higher level. So something that you use in your HSM or your wallet software to regenerate the keys or move out the funds in case you are dead or you lost access to your wallet.
Okay, and so far the solutions that you've looked at, are they ones that you've created yourself? I mean, people like RGB, I think, do solutions like that, and there are other people who do. Or did you create your own? Or
I didn't create my own. Let's say I used some existing algorithm. Basically, the way I went for is similar to an MPC solution, basically. So where you basically simplify it, you split your keys in a certain amount of shards, and you require a certain number of shards together to reconstruct the key. But this could also be on, as I said before, on the smart contract level, it could be like in a smart contract, in the memory part of, in the memory of the smart contract, you say, okay, this public key with this other public key, with this other public key, which is, I don't know, my girlfriend, my father, and another person, can unlock X amount of funds by doing this transaction together.
Okay, so what innovations do you find the most promising to resolve these security and custody issues?
So as I mentioned, I like the idea of MPC, even though there are not many implementations, open implementations yet, and that still need for sure a lot of battle testing. There is also, I find very, very fascinating also zero knowledge for privacy, but also for scalability in particular, because it promised to allow people to basically put off-chain a lot of the calculation that today we're trying to do on the blockchain itself and only write the proofs on the chain. So this would probably allow us to reduce a lot of the fees because we use way less space on the chain and then to build way more complicated, operationally complicated solution. And that's something that we need because the blockchain needs some scalability. And of course, like AI also, everyone's talking about AI now. Maybe it's overestimated, but for sure it will help a lot, I think, in stuff like code reviews, finding trivial bugs, and then productivity in general.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to some rapid fire questions.
Yep.
Something about you that your coworkers don't know.
Oh, I wasn't really ready for this. Something that they don't know. Like on the work side, a little more than that. I don't know.
Or like, say, something that you do in your free time that, or something that you did that might surprise your coworkers.
I can say I was, for something they would be probably surprised today is that I won some even on the country level, tries in, so I was doing this type of run, kind of a marathon when I was a little kid. And we also arrived second in the Italian championship. It's like a couple things. So it was, probably they don't know, and probably they would laugh because today I'm not really like a kind of a sports person. But yeah.
Okay.
The first thing that came to my mind, to be honest.
Okay, good answer. Next question. How did you earn your first paycheck?
My first paycheck. So I did a bit of everything, to be honest, because, you know, I'm not coming from a very, very wealthy family, let's say. So I also needed, so when I was a kid, I wanted more money. So I, maybe on summer, I was working, I worked with the gardeners. When I moved to the university also to pay a bit of the expenses in the university. So I worked in a flower shop. You know, that's my my plan B is if I get really tired of IT, I would love to buy a farm and do wine. I love wine. I would love to produce wine. And then, you know, so I'm also kind of a nature guy. Yeah.
Good. All right. Back to the other extreme from you liked wine. So let's go to the other extreme, back to programming. You mentioned artificial intelligence. What do you use ChatGPT-3 for?
Yeah, so I'm using ChatGPT since day one it came out, and it really blew my mind. To be honest, I wasn't expecting to see in my lifetime something like that. I'm using it for a lot of different things, especially like, you know, prototyping code. So like code snippets or fixing some code or refactoring code, but also correcting writings like the text, both in Italian and then in English. It works pretty well, and it gives you like a lot of suggestion. Also for preparing, like, for example, speeches and slides and asking general questions. The only limitation that I have at the moment, and that's why I'm looking for an alternative now, is that I'm not writing anything sensitive. You know, if I don't want to share some specific code or whatever, I'm not asking. Instead, I'm doing it on my own. Every time I copy paste something, I try to delete the names and the personal data. But I was actually in the last couple of days, I saw that a lot of other trained models were released from, for example, Google and other players, which you can run locally. So you don't have the problem anymore because you're not sending your inquiry to your question to a server, but everything is local. So that's what I'm trying to do now, to have one at least that I can run locally and they can ask whatever I want.
Okay, let's do two more rapid fire questions. Somebody who inspires you?
So there's a lot of people that inspires me. Maybe it's a lame answer, I don't know, but if the aliens would come to Earth tomorrow and ask me who I would select, I would probably go for Elon Musk, because I think he did something incredible. You know, this is not perfect. He has a lot of problems too, but he achieved many things altogether that a lot of people thought they were impossible. And now he's getting a lot of hate but to be honest, I think, you know, it's kind of a unique genius probably in our lifetime. Then there are many hackers, Mitnick just died, unfortunately, rest in peace. And then I have some minor hackers that I follow more on the local scene.
Who was the hacker who just died? I don't know. Mitnick's? What did you say?
Mitnick, yeah.
Okay, I don't know.
He was one of the most famous hackers. See, he's not also a lot of people say that it's kind of an impostor. He wasn't as good as he was trying to show. But he wrote a couple of books, which I read when I was a kid and just inspired me. I go to John McAfee, was a big fan, also another controversial guy, but it was really it was just inspiring for me. I'm not saying I agree with everything.
Okay, great. Thanks. And finally, one last rapid fire question. Best investment you ever made that was not financial?
I would say founding my own company last year, because, you know, you said not financial and it sounds financial, but actually it's not entirely, because I realized that basically even in the condition that I wasn't getting the same money that I was getting in my last salary, you know, I was an executive in kind of a well-funded company, so I had a very, very good salary, but I was working a lot. I was really burned out and all the time and now I can kind of manage my time and I can work for maybe a bit less money sometime, but also, you know, working half of the time, spending more time with my family. And yeah, I think that's really, really good for your mental health and for having a better life in general.
Okay, great. So where can people find out more about you? You have your own company, which is Sig9. So do you want to explain to us a little bit what it does and where people can find out more about your company or hook up with you?
Definitely. So a quick description maybe on my company. Yeah. So Sig9 is my security consulting company, and it's also basically my self-funding way to keep getting an inbound cash flow while I'm also slowly progressing on developing some internal products, which hopefully in the future we will switch from consulting to be a product company sooner or later, or also continue to do both. The idea is that, you know, I have this couple of ideas, and I can't really speak too much about it, but of security tools, which I think are still missing in the industry. And yeah, you know, I, without asking for external funding, which is also always tricky, and they also have, you know, certain conditions which might not be very, very favorable for you. In this way, I can still handle everything on myself and hopefully still deliver sooner or later. So people can find information on Sig9 in our website, sig9.ca.ch. Very basic website, but you know, they can always get in touch with me on, you know, on LinkedIn. There is my personal website, michelefederici.com, or our, you know, GitHub. I'm also hanging around in Zurich. I'm a part of some groups here. I'm often at meetups and conferences in the area. So I'm happy to, so if anyone wants to get in touch or also hang out, and around here, I'm happy to feel free to get in.
Okay, Michele, so it was a pleasure to speak to you, and I hope we'll be in touch again. And I'll leave the references to Sig9 and to your LinkedIn and to your website. I'll leave those in the show notes. Okay.
Thanks.
It was a pleasure to speak to you.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure also for me, and I will talk to you soon.
I love it.
If you want to follow other things I do, you can subscribe to my Substack newsletter called The Swiss Roads View, The Butterfly Effect. There I discuss crypto, but I discuss other things like business, art, or whatever I feel like discussing at that moment. You will also be informed every time there's a new episode of the podcast. You can find the link on the internet at The Swiss Roads View, The Butterfly Effect on Substack.com.